Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, May 19th, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
Great to be here.
Larry, we know that Donald Trump is going to talk with Vladimir Putin today.
They're talking right now.
Yeah, they're talking right now.
Yeah. The call was supposed to take place at 10 a.m. Washington time. Initially, they said noon, but then Carolyn Leavitt announced it would be at 10 a.m. So
it's in progress as we talk.
As we talk.
Yeah.
They're talking, we're talking.
Yeah, exactly. How, in your opinion, what are the main goals of Donald Trump in this talk? And from what we've seen in Istanbul, it doesn't seem that much of option on the table for Donald Trump. I would wonder what would be the main goal on his part right now, talking with Putin?
Well, Trump's delusional. That's the simplest thing I can say. He does not understand his own role in helping create this conflict. He added one country to NATO during his presidency. So he moved NATO east towards Russia, which is Russia's red line. They have, they put up for 26 years with the expansion of NATO to the east, despite multiple promises, not just from James Baker, but from other members of NATO at the time as well, like Genscher in Germany, that NATO would not expand to the east. And yet they broke that promise. So, That's the root cause for Russia, but Trump keeps acting like, the Russia and Ukraine are like two kids fighting. They just don't like each other. And I got to get in there and separate them, give them time out, put them in their corners. I mean, it's crazy. He thinks, the Russians just hate the Ukrainians. No, they don't. And that's where, Trump sees this very much as like a personal thing between Vladimir Putin and Zelensky. It's not. And so, Trump right off the bat doesn't understand. So he's going to pressure, or thinks he's going to pressure Putin into cease fire. And Putin's going to say, no. Not going to happen. There's not going to be a, quote, ceasefire. We will sit down and talk about the negotiations, but the first thing that must happen is Ukraine's got to vacate the four Russian provinces, because they are now Russia or Russian republics, are part of the Federation of Russian states. And, if they don't do that, then, we're not going to really have much more to talk about. But, that's what's on the table. they may, what could come out of this talk today? Possibly they could agree to meet in person, Trump and Putin. But I think Putin's going to make it very clear to Donald Trump that, what you're pushing for this unilateral ceasefire, basically. It's not going to happen. Now, Trump was on the phone yesterday with, Merz, Starmer, Macron, Tusk of Poland, and Meloni of Italy. And so no readout as far as what was said on that call. But I'm sure they said, hey, you got to insist on a ceasefire. That's what is, and maybe he agreed to do that. Or maybe his goal was to tell them what he was going to say to Putin. But regardless, Trump's playing a very foolish game, because he's pretending as if the United States had no role at all in the buildup of the Ukrainian military, no role at all in bringing Ukraine as a de facto member of NATO. No role at all in targeting Russia. And, and since he's been president, he's continued to allow weapons to flow. So I think I'll be very, very surprised if both sides come out happy. I suspect Trump's going to come out and condemn Putin as a problem. And, you know, Trump, the optimism, you know, I held, it was, you know, I didn't really believe it strongly, but I was hopeful that Trump would seize the opportunity to, one, end the war in Ukraine and reach a peace deal with Iran. None of that's going to happen. You know, so Trump keeps saying some very, very stupid things with respect to what's going on in the world. He doesn't understand.
Here is, Larry, what former Defense Secretary Robert Gates suggested in terms of, he said that Donald Trump is not ready for a personal meeting with Vladimir Putin. And here is the reason he mentioned about
Trump not to take that face-to-face, even if Vladimir Putin was willing to do it?
I would say you need to figure out some leverage that you have going into that meeting with Putin. What can you do that puts more pressure to bear on Putin to make him believe his interests are served by not just a ceasefire, but a basically at least freezing things in place?
What type of leverage?
Don't get me going on Bob Gates. I mean, look, he was the director of intelligence when I was an analyst. He's a liar. He is dishonest. He is a manipulator of intelligence. I witnessed it firsthand. One of my buddies was the South African analyst, a guy named John Reed. And John, the request came from the White House. We want to know if Nelson Mandela is a communist. And so John, you know, wrote the response back, you know, well, Nelson Mandela has relationships or friendships or associations with these different people who are communists. Nelson Mandela is not a communist. Bob Gates edited that piece. He only took out one little word. Let's see if you can guess what word he took out, Nima. Huh? You're muted.
He's not a communist. He's
not. He took out not.
So, just removed the not.
So Nelson Mandela is a communist. That's Bob Gates. Now, Gates is again delusional. Yeah, we got to find that leverage over Putin. We don't have leverage over Vladimir Putin. Period. Those days are over. We're either going to agree to Russia's terms, which ultimately means NATO's got to back the hell off, or we're going to risk going to war with Russia, because Russia's going to militarily destroy Ukraine and in the process eviscerate NATO. That's simple. People need to understand it. That's, you know, if Putin sort of, if he's, oh yeah, yeah, you're right, Mr. Trump. We'll stop where we are. We won't go any farther, and we'll trust you. The Russians have been down that road already with us. They recognize you cannot trust the United States to keep any agreement. We've walked away from the anti-ballistic missile treaty agreement. Trump walked away from the intermediate nuclear forces agreement. Name one agreement that the United States has kept its word on. From the Russian perspective, that would be zero, none.
Larry, these people who are pushing for more leverage to be possessed by Donald Trump on Putin, here is one of the main goals of these people. And it seems that they're pushing so much from the U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. Here is what he said.
to impose sanctions against Russia?
Well, I think we will see what happens when both sides get to the table. President Trump has made it very clear that if President Putin does not negotiate in good faith, that the United States will not hesitate to up the Russia sanctions along with our European partners. What I can tell you is the sanctions were very ineffective during the Biden administration because they kept them low because they were afraid of pushing up domestic oil prices.
Very quickly, how long for the timeline until you move to sanctions? Obviously, there's a call.
Larry, you see the same strategy in Yemen. They came to power to say, no, Joe Biden didn't fight the Yemenis the way that we are able.
He was weak. We're going to be tough.
I've seen the same story.
Look, the United States and Russia share one thing in common. Both countries are rich in natural resources. Both countries are capable of feeding themselves without having to rely upon anyone on the outside. And both countries have all of the energy resources that they need to meet their domestic demand. But, you know, the United States has opted to import some. But if you had to build a wall around each country and say which country would survive, Russia is the one that would survive. Russia doesn't need trade with other countries in order to stay alive. The United States does. The United States, in terms of its trade relations with Mexico, Canada, and China, we're really very dependent upon China for a lot of the consumer items. But when you look at the issue of debt, that is that's where it really starts to come apart for the United States. Russia's debt is about 14 to 20% of its gross domestic product. The United States debt is 125% of our gross domestic product, and it's getting worse with each passing day. People like Besant, they're just arrogant and ignorant of Russia. They think, all we got to do is really put the Russia's economy's weak. Well, I started hearing that and I started looking up some facts. In 1995, 7% of Russian citizens were considered in the middle class. Okay? That means you're looking at like 90% of the country in lower middle class in some form of poverty. Today, that number is around 50%. Quite a dramatic turnaround in 30 years. In the United States, the number that were considered middle class in 1995 were around between 55 and 60%. Now that number is at 51%. So what's happening in the United States, instead of the middle class growing, instead of people becoming wealthier, it's going in reverse. And yet the United States continues to say, oh, we're the best. Oh, we're so much better than everybody else. Oh, yeah. Look at the literacy rates. In the United States, 54% of the population read at the sixth grade level or lower. Okay, our current literacy rate is like 74%. In Russia, it's 97%. So, start picking out markers in terms of which country can produce hypersonic weapons, hypersonic missiles that actually work in combat. Oh, that'd be Russia. United States has yet to produce one. Russia's got at least three. So, the United States is indulging this fantasy of we're so good. It's like the evil queen was in Snow White, mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest of them all? Just because you keep looking at yourself and you've told the mirror, you tell me I'm the fairest, so I'm going to break you. Okay. Yeah, you're the fairest. You're the best. So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's I actually say the relationship's not that complicated. It's pretty simple. The United States is locked in a delusional state. We believe things about ourselves that are just not true. And at the same thing, we believe things about Russia that are not true. And those false beliefs lead us to make decisions that later, you know, they blow up on us.
Do you think that in the it's so important, Larry, to put ourselves in the shoes of those people who are pushing for more leverage on the part of the West and Russia? But in your opinion, beyond sanctions, is there anything that comes to their mind that would be substantial for Russia?
No. Well, they again, they believe all we got to do is, you know, prevent Russia from earning money off of oil and natural gas. And they assume that in that they're going to pressure India and China. In fact, I was just listening to Carolyn Leavitt. She had held a press conference this morning that started a little after 9 a.m. on the East Coast. And she persists with this mythology of, oh, yeah, we put those tariffs on China, and, man, they came running. They came, boy, they were hurting. They came to us. It proves Donald Trump is right. Well, it's just nonsense. That's not what happened. It was the United States that called China. Hey, can we talk, please? I said, okay. What do you want to talk about? Oh, we'll cut that tariff back to 30%. And China said, okay, well, we'll do the same. We're going to treat you like you treat us. But I haven't seen anything in the press to show that China said, oh, and those bans we imposed on the rare earth minerals, we're lifting those. We're going to give those to you so you can build more weapons that you can attack us with. I didn't see China do that. And China is doing other things. They're, they used to send a lot of students to the United States, and those students paid a lot of money, making U.S. colleges profit. Chinese have pulled the plug on that. And so there are a lot of U.S. schools that are really suffering because they don't have those Chinese students around anymore. That's number one. Which, you know, from just an intelligence standpoint, I maintain one of the reasons the United States did that over the years and encouraged the Chinese students to come was so CIA could actually, identify, target, try to recruit people that would go back to China and become cooperators of the CIA. So now, you know, we're busy making that impossible for the Chinese to come here, too, in some respects. So it just, you know, when you put this entire picture together, it's just you've got a White House that's just out of touch with reality.
You mentioned China and India. We know that China is totally on board right now. It's not, you cannot separate China from Russia. But how about India? Even with the conflict between India and Pakistan, somehow the United States try to side with India. It seems that they're trying to do something with India, but the question would be how successful that would be to influence Russia, in your opinion.
Well, again, that's the story the White House is telling. I don't believe them. You know, I don't believe a word of it. Other countries were intervening, trying to talk to both sides. Yes, the Chinese trying to calm the Pakistanis down. The Russians are talking to Modi. But again, with China, you know, go back 5-6 years, the relationships between China and India were tense. And, it was not seen as possible to have that settled. Well, along comes BRICS. Along comes the U.S. sanctions, where the United States is pressuring other countries. And all of a sudden, India and China find themselves sort of in the same boat and recognizing that the United States is not a friend. The United States is a bully. The United States We're like an abusive spouse. You're going to do what I say or I'm going to hit you. Hey, who wants to be in that kind of relationship? And particularly, you know, Trump talked very tough about, you know, he imposed sanctions on like 180 countries, including India. But it, you know, and he said, oh, yeah, those countries, they're coming, as he said, to kiss my ass. Well, they're not kissing his ass. You know, people like, well, in the case of India, India didn't buckle. And then there were some threats being made about the preventing India from building Apple phones. So, you know, I think India, while it may have been inclined initially to maintain really good relations with the United States, they're keeping the U.S. more at arm's length now, because we're not a reliable partner. You know, you saw that with Japan. Japan showed up in Washington last week, and you know, the talk about the tariffs, and it's, you know, they said, you know, what can you reduce the tariffs? And you know, United States reply was, tell us what you're willing to pay. And the Japanese said, we're not going to bargain with ourselves. You know, you tell us what the deal is, and they walked away. So, you know, the only big, beautiful deal Trump got was with the United Kingdom. You know, what a joke. So, you know, they operate. There really is a level of delusional fantasy on the part of the Trump administration right now, at least with respect to foreign policy and economic policy.
Have you ever figured out the sort of relationship, the way that the United States sees the two countries? We had a coup in Bangladesh recently, Larry, and we know how Bangladesh is important for India. And you see the conflict between Pakistan and India. What does the United States want? Somehow, I really believe before, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that the United States is in favor of Pakistan because they wanted to do something with BRICS. But right now, it seems somehow they're trying to manipulate that region. I don't know who's doing this, but
you think they're just now trying to manipulate that region? I have a news flash for you. The United States has been meddling, conducting intelligence operations to destabilize and cause unrest there for 70 years, 75 years, since the start of the CIA. You know, the CIA's presence in the CIA has had a much closer relationship with Pakistan than with India, simply because we've used Pakistan as a military base for launching military operations in Afghanistan, first against the Soviets in the 1980s, and then later against the Taliban. We used it going back to 1959, 1960, when they set up the air base for the CIA to fly the U-2 mission over Soviet Union. So I can't rule out that the Western intelligence, I believe Western intelligence was involved in the terrorist attack on that tourist site that took place on April 22nd in Kashmir. And it was done for one purpose, to stir up conflict between Pakistan and India. Now, the ones that came up with that idea, they didn't calculate on the possibility that both sides were willing to go nuclear. And when India reportedly hit the Pakistani bunker that stored nuclear weapons, that set off alarm bells. Now, I don't know if that was a lucky blow or they were deliberately targeting it, but, you know, that sort of rattled everybody in the region. And I think particularly countries like Russia and China intervened along with Iran. Iran does have some sway with Pakistan. So, But the United States, we're not a force for peace. We're not a force for promoting development. We say those things, but it's all about we're going to create fights between people if necessary, just in order to keep make ourselves strong.
The problem, Larry, with the Trump administration is that whatever they're trying to do, it comes to the mainstream media. They're talking about it before talking with the with their counterparts, with the other party involved in that. Here is what Witkoff said about the talks, direct talks today as we talk between the two presidents, the president of the United States and Russia.
Unmatched. I think it's important. His sensibilities are that he's got to get on the phone with President Putin, and that is going to clear up some of the logjam and get us to the place that we need to get to. And I think it's going to be a very successful call.
What did you make of Putin's not going to Istanbul? I mean, President Trump even offered to adjust his trip to be there himself. Why was it, do you think, that Putin decided not to go?
Look, I don't want to comment on his motivations. I think in some respects it may have something to do with the delegation that he had sent to the original Istanbul talks, but those were different circumstances back then as compared to today. I want to leave it to, I want to be a bit more positive about this. I believe that the president is going to have a successful call with Vladimir Putin.
Now, in your opinion, what was the main reason of Vladimir Putin not going to Istanbul?
There was no reason.
Was there anything to talk about? Was there any sort of agreement between the two, I don't know, the two parties before to it doesn't seem to me that presidents would talk about the details of a deal, because that could be achieved by the teams that the two parties would provide, not by the presidents.
There was no reason for him to go. That was, you know, manufactured by the West, trying to, you know, create the narrative that Putin's the one who's the roadblock to peace. Putin on June 14th, 2024, laid out, you know, sort of six things that have to happen in order to be able to talk about a ceasefire. And the most critical one of those was the one that was reiterated again last week, that Ukraine's got to pull out of Zaporizhia, Kherson, Donetsk, and Luhansk. Notice the West was acting like, oh my God, that's, how can they ask that? That's been on the table for a year now. I mean, coming up in June. It's not new, but the West is acting like, oh my God, this is new and outrageous. No, it's been his position. So that, you know, pull out, stop the NATO supply of weapons, stop the NATO supply of intelligence, stop the war, and then, you know, we'll sit down and talk about a ceasefire, how we work this out. But Putin is not going to give back Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, or Luhansk. Ain't going back, nor is Crimea. And Zelensky can hold his breath and pound his you know, fists on the table and jump up and down all he wants. It's not going to change that reality. And, you know, I think Witkoff is overly, he thinks, you know, foolishly, that Donald Trump has some leverage over Putin. Trump has no leverage over Putin. Because, look, the fact is that if this war is not Putin's war. When you go back and listen to the speech that he gave on February 24th of 2022, when the special military operation started, he was very, very clear that this, you know, Russia had tried through diplomacy, tried through talks to, you know, basically get the West to back the hell off. Stop coming after us. And the West wouldn't. And so Russia said, fine, we're taking this step. And, you know, the initial military attack by Russia was simply designed to create pressure to get Ukraine to a negotiating table, which they did. And that culminated in the negotiations in Istanbul. Now, you know, I know that John Helmer's on your show saying that the account that the West interfered and took that agreement off the table is nonsense. John is just dead ass wrong. You know, Lavrov has repeatedly described what happened. That, and he said it again, it was either yesterday or day before yesterday at this, you know, foreign policy conference, that, you know, Russia, the agreement in principle that they signed off on was presented by Ukraine. Russia was willing to make one more deal with the Ukrainians. And, you know, it was the West that interfered with that. And at that point, Russia then had to change its strategy from using some military pressure to coerce negotiations to make negotiations possible to defeating Ukraine militarily. And that, you know, the Russia was probably not fully prepared to do that, looking back now in June and July of 2022. But once they started the mobilization in September and following the withdrawal from some areas like Kharkiv and Kherson, the Russian war machine geared up, and it's been an entirely one-sided affair since then. So Witkoff, I believe that is going to be a good positive call. Putin will be polite. He will be calm. But he's not going to surrender, you know, agree to a ceasefire without the conditions that he's laid down being met. Because frankly, if he did something like that, I think the military in Russia and other key political allies would move against him. Because he's already facing accusations of being too soft.
There, if we assume that the only option left for Donald Trump would be what's going on the battlefield, is there any region on the battlefield in which Ukrainians are winning or somehow possess some sort of leverage on Russians?
No, zero. In fact, you know, they've done the body exchanges of cadavers of dead soldiers. They did one in March, did one in April, and did another one in May. The bodies are being turned over at a rate for each dead Russian. The Ukrainians are getting 25 to 27 dead Ukrainians. A 1 to 27 death rate. You know, that's called attrition. Now, some would argue, well, that's just because, Russia is advancing, and in the advance, Ukraine can't recover its casualties, and Russia can then pick its casualties up and move them to the rear. Okay, so you're admitting, you know, if that's the case, you're admitting that Russia is advancing dramatically across the front, because they went, oh, it's a stalemate. This war is a stalemate. No, it's not a stalemate. It's, you know, Russia moving forward at its pace, destroying Ukrainian manpower, destroying Western supplied military equipment. And they're going to keep doing it until Ukraine surrenders or breaks.
Larry, the other part of the conflict is in, as you've mentioned, and in your response to my first question, is the case of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And here is what Witkoff said about Iran.
With Iran, can you give us a sense of what is the outline of the deal that President Trump wants to get with Iran?
Well, the president has been very clear. He wants to solve this this conflict diplomatically and with dialogue. And he's given all the signals. He's directly sent letters to the Supreme Leader. I have been dispatched to deliver that message as well, and I've delivered it. But on the other hand, we have one very, very clear red line, and that is enrichment. We cannot allow even 1% of an enrichment capability. We've delivered a proposal to the Iranians that we think addresses some of this without disrespecting them. And so that's important. We want to get to a solution here, and we think that we will be able to. But everything begins from our standpoint, John, with a deal that does not include enrichment. We cannot have that because enrichment enables weaponization, and we will not allow a bomb to get here. But short of that, there are all kinds of ways for us to achieve our goals in this negotiation. We think that we will be meeting sometime this week in Europe, and we hope that it will lead to some real positivity. And that's where we are, sir.
Yeah, delusional. Iran's not going to go for that. Iran's made it very clear. We are a nation. We're entitled to do peaceful development of our nuclear energy. They have a signed agreement with Russia for that express purpose, which is Russia's in a position to guarantee that Iran will not build, will not enrich at a level to produce a nuclear weapon. Like I said, Donald Trump had a chance to make a deal here, and he's going to walk away from this, and then he's going to have to say, okay, we're going to show those Iranians, and if he decides to launch an attack on Iran, Iran will defeat the attack. Iran will inflict significant damage on U.S. Military capabilities. They will destroy the Al Udeid Air Force Base at Qatar, and probably shut down the supply of oil coming out of the Persian Gulf. That's going to help Iran tremendously. I mean, Russia tremendously with respect to, because all of a sudden the price of oil is going to go through the roof. Everyone's going to need Iranian oil, Russian oil. And, you know, Iran's ability to inflict damage not only on the United States, but on Israel. This can get out of control. Iran doesn't want that. Iran has been negotiating in good faith. It's the United States that's not negotiating in good faith. It's the United States, again, living in this fantasy world that we can tell everybody else what they got to do. They got to do what we say because we're in charge. And yet the Houthis said, nah, go ahead. You can stay out there. You can stay out there till our grandchildren are in charge. And the United States could not defeat the Houthis. We could not stop the Houthis from launching missiles into Israel. We could not stop the Houthis from preventing Israeli flagships or ships owned by Israelis from traveling to Israel. Couldn't do it. We had to pull out. And now we think we're going to take on Iran? Give me a break. You know, when you've got somebody that's delusional, sometimes they got to get their nose, you know, they may think they're a championship prize fighter. It's only when they step in the ring and they get their nose broken that they realize, oh, maybe I'm not as tough as I thought it was.
And we know that the foreign minister of Iran has responded to what Witkoff said. He said that we're gonna continue. We're gonna enrich uranium. Doesn't matter what the United States says about the deal, with or without the deal, we're gonna enrich uranium.
Right. Yeah.
Why do they need, Larry? The question is, why do they need to talk about it? Because this is one of the main points of the talks between the two parties. What do they need to talk about it on the mainstream media? Why not? Whatever they want to talk about, they can talk in their meetings. It's not a matter for the mainstream media to talk about.
Well, apparently, Trump is under pressure. Reportedly, 72 senators, some, you know, large number have told the White House, under no circumstances can you cut a deal with Iran that will allow them to continue to enrich uranium. So, you know, Trump is caught. He's politically in a difficult situation. And that may be one reason why he's talking about it. Again, this is an example where our political process is so broken in the United States that we're incapable of acting responsibly in the international environment. You know, that was, you go back to the whole Russiagate, the fabrication of the lie, you know, the big lie pushed that Trump was beholden and under the control of the Russians and the Russians were interfering in our election. That was created entirely to handcuff Trump and prevent him from having any kind of reasonable relationship with Russia during his first term as president. And, you know, I talked to both Larry, Colonel Wilkerson, and to Doug McGregor. I did about a 50-minute discussion with Doug about his time working with the Trump administration, to try to pinpoint, was Donald Trump not aware of what was going on with Ukraine during his administration? The fact that these military exercises were increasing, that the size of the Ukrainian army was being built up, weapons, you know, that there were the weapons supplies, the javelins, and then, you know, the B-52s flying along the Crimea coast. And Doug said basically, no, Trump really was not aware. Trump wasn't calling the shots on that. So this is a sort of another example of how the deep state has its own agenda and is pursuing it, the intelligence and defense communities. And that Trump, Trump was misled, is I guess the best way to put it. He didn't understand what was going on. Jump ahead now. Does he really fully understand, or are they, you know, giving him the mushroom treatment, keep him in the dark and cover him with manure? You know.
Yeah, I think that could be the case, because we know what has happened with the case of Syria. Donald Trump wanted to withdraw from Syria, but they increased the number of forces in Syria instead of reducing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had actual people in the first administration that, ignored his orders. In fact, that's Doug in our conversation goes through in great detail how Trump tried to get a withdrawal out of Afghanistan underway and would have kept the U.S. force at Bagram. And, you know, even people like Kash Patel ignored his orders. So this is headed in a bad direction again. I was somewhat hopeful that Trump would seize the opportunity with Iran in particular, take Iran off the table, and then stop the murder of the Palestinian people. But, Trump is the great enabler. He's shown some strength and personal courage in resisting the political attacks against him, the whole lawfare. But at the same time, he's a weak, insecure guy. And, has found more reasons not to do the right thing than to do the right thing.
We thought that Witkoff would be someone different from the establishment, from the decision makers, those people who have been in the political system of the United States for many years. He's a outsider, is an outsider. But when you look at the way that for the case of Iran, he talked first, he said that we're going to accept enrichment to 3.461, 3.67, something like that.
Well, 3.6, 3.6. 3.6%, 3.7%.
Yeah. Then he's right now he's just moving, changing his rhetoric, and I was wondering if he has some sort of agenda in the background of his mind by putting. He's not someone that has been in the political system and who knows how the system works, how the lies work. How can we understand that?
Well, no, he initially was agreeable to that, but then he got back to Washington and all of the other players that, have a say in this, from State Department, Marco Rubio, Department of Defense, Pete Hegseth, but then key members of Congress. And they, they put out, no, none, zero. That's AIPAC. The AIPAC weighed in heavily, called in everybody that's been taking money from it and said, no, and hell no. So Witkoff had to, bring his views around to conform to that. And I said, Israel is in the process of committing suicide, and unfortunately, it's taking a lot of Palestinians with it as it is dying, but it's not making itself stronger diplomatically or militarily, and it's really becoming more dependent on the United States. And at some point, this relationship between Israel and the United States, it's going to break, because the under 50 crowd, when they're looking at the signs of starvation, children starving to death, and the Israelis insisting those children are terrorists, it's heinous. It is the face of evil. And Israel has become the face of evil.
Here is, Larry, what Marco Rubio said about Israel.
Working on that on an hourly basis. It's something we're all very focused on and continue to be very supportive of. And I hope we'll have good news soon in that regard, but I think some impediments remain.
So are you asking Israel to slow down this military push? And the Qatari prime minister told Fox News that there was a deal being put together for all hostages, or many hostages, to be released after Idan Alexander, that American Israeli, was released recently. But then the Israeli military bombed a hospital, killing 70 civilians, and everything went sideways. Is that your understanding of what happened?
I would say
it was
that
this lack of care of collateral damage?
No, the way I would characterize it is that this war could end immediately, and Israel's made that clear. It could end immediately if Hamas surrenders and gives up their weapons and demilitarizes and releases all the hostages, including the deceased ones. They did that, this conflict would end. That's been true from the very beginning. It's been true for months now. They're the ones that have chosen not to accept that offer. That said, we continue to work and do everything we can through diplomatic channels and private means to bring about an end to this conflict in a way that ends Hamas and provides the people of Gaza the opportunity at a prosperous and peaceful future. That also ensures Israel's security. So we're working on that. We've never stopped working on that. We've never stopped taking efforts to make that possible, and that continues. Even as I speak to you now, there are people working on that. So we're going to continue to do that, and that's the outcome we want to see, and hopefully the sooner the better.
Larry, if I were to define Marco Rubio, I would say he's the meaning, literally the meaning of nothing burger. He's just talking and offering nothing, just repeating the same sort of rhetoric that he has been doing for more than 3 months.
They're asking the Palestinians in Gaza to kill themselves. Yeah, have Hamas surrender, give up? No, I wouldn't advise Hamas to do that. Again, I went back through. The United States has gotten away, and Israel's gotten away with labeling Hamas as this horrific terrorist group. And, they pushed the narrative that October 7th was, oh, my God, this is the worst thing since the Holocaust. And you're going, okay, what? You claim in the Holocaust 6 million Jews were executed. And now on October 7th, 1,255 die. which at least maybe 300 of those were killed by you, the Israelis, yourselves. And you're saying that's the worst thing since the Holocaust? Can we be serious? I mean, when you get into a lie that's that despicable and dishonest, you know that you're not dealing with rational actors. So the facts are this: Israel has been unable to militarily defeat Hamas after 21 months of unconstrained warfare. They've killed tens of thousands. It's, you know, the Palestinian Authority reports close to 60,000 now dead. Others estimate that number could be in excess of 100,000, approaching 200,000. But we're talking about, you know, almost 2 million people. And they've been living under conditions that, you know, you can't even describe it as hell. Hell would be a vacation compared to what these people are experiencing. And the United States is in a position to stop it, and we won't. We keep enabling the Israelis, the Zionists, to do it. And in the process, you know, the Zionists, they've destroyed the moral center of Israel. They've turned Israel into a monster. And the divisions within Israel on this point are growing. You know, notice that they talk about this Operation Gideon's Sword. I think that's what they want to call this latest offense to try to murder the Palestinians, clear out the northern half of Gaza. But they will only use regular army, or the guys who are actually fully enlisted, not reservists, because they're worried that the reservists would not follow orders. Think about that.
Larry, do you think the Zionism in Israel, after all, is getting stronger, or somehow the population in Israel? Because it's not just about Gaza. We know that Israelis are somehow suffering from these attacks from Yemen. They don't have that sort of calmness in the country to go to the beach, to all the places that they want. They have to put some pressure on the government in Israel. And here comes the question, what do they want to be in the near future? Do they want to just murdering people, or do they want the government to be more rational, to do something that would benefit them in a long run?
Well, they're fractured. The society is fractured. You've probably got a majority, let's say 51-55%, who are these, I don't want to call them ultra, they're not Haredi, they're not the ultra Orthodox, you know, the ones that wear the side curls and the black hats and, you know, dress up like male nuns. These are the settlers who insist that the Torah says that all of that land is theirs, and that anybody that lives there, Amalek, are to be destroyed, woman, child, man. And, you know, they're a majority now. They reflect the extremist views that were once associated with Meir Kahane, this crazed rabbi saw no way to live with Palestinians. You've got, you know, probably 35% of the population that are sort of the traditional Europeanized Jew, not religious, very secular, they're not guided by this notion that this is a biblical promise of this land, but wanting to have Israel as a nation. So that division exists. And unfortunately, I think even within that group, there's still a number that are unwilling to abide any kind of relationship with the Palestinians. That's why even before the Smotrich and Ben-Gavirs took over, Israel for years was funneling money to Hamas in order to create Hamas as an alternative to the Palestinian Liberation Authority. And it was done entirely to sabotage any prospect of a legitimate peace deal being reached. So this, you know, I don't see how Israel survives intact as a nation, because the population, people are leaving. They're not sticking around. And they're going to become more isolated in the world. The world's not lining up to say, oh, yeah, we think Israel's great. The greater the loss of life on the part of the Palestinians and the starving to death, the greater will be the international pressure on Israel. You know, they could be booted out of the United Nations is one possibility.
Getting back, Larry, to the case of Iran and the United States, I don't know if you've noticed what Donald Trump said in his visit to the Middle East. For the first time, he said that we're going to reach a deal with Iran, or I'm not going to let them to sell any oil, instead of saying that we're going to attack them, as he was talking about it before. To my mind, when he changed his rhetoric, it seems that he feels that he's not going to get a deal with Iran. Because when he goes to extreme to explain his position, we are going to attack Iran or we're going to get a deal.
Yeah,
we know that saying of barking dog seldom bite, and that comes to my mind. But when he just goes that, oh, we are not going to let them sell oil, and it seems that even in his mind that he's not there to make a deal with Iran. That's why they're changing their rhetoric on their part. Enrichment 3.6, and right now no enrichment in Iran, then maybe push for ballistic missiles, all the defense system of Iran. Do you feel that they're on the path of just not reaching any sort of agreement with Iran?
Yeah, no, they're not serious. They're captive of the Israeli lobby, the Zionist lobby. AIPAC would not allow a deal to be made. And AIPAC's goal is to get the United States to carry out an attack on Iran. And, you know, if the United States does that, it will really mark the end of Donald Trump's presidency. Because he will violate, you know, just like George H.W. Bush, I was around for that. Read my lips, no new taxes. And then he imposed taxes. Then came the election and people threw his ass out. And, you know, he was the one that won the Gulf War against Iraq back then. I mean, they had a big parade in Washington, D.C., troops marching, everybody, yay, George H.W. Bush, you're great. He broke that promise out. Trump has promised not to embroil us in needless foreign wars. And if he pursues this path with Iran, he's going to, of not negotiating in good faith and imposing unrealistic demands on Iran, it's going to blow up in his face.
Marco Rubio is pushing for snapback sanctions, that term that was mentioned in JCPOA.
Yeah.
It seems that in their mind, when I look at the snapback sanctions, it's about Europe. The United States is out of the contract. It's all about Europe, China, and Russia. I don't see China and Russia going against Iran.
Well,
Europe is not in a position that they were before during JCPOA. Europe is in a much, much weaker position right now, and I don't know why. Can they achieve with this sort of a strategy on the part of the United States with the term of snapback sanctions?
Well, when those snapback sanctions were negotiated as part of that, JCPOA in 2015, Iran was in a much, much weaker position. And you basically had even China and Russia united with the West on imposing those restrictions. That's not the case now. So China and Russia are now firmly on Iran's side, and Russia signed this comprehensive strategic agreement, security arrangement with Iran. Iran is actually, you know, it's not embroiled in a war in Yemen like it was, you know, where the United States was using the war in Yemen as a way to go after Iran, pitching Iran versus Saudis. The Iranians have reconciled with the Saudis. Iran was bogged down in the war in Syria, trying to prevent ISIS from taking over the country. They've now, you know, they're now no longer in that. So Iran's in a much better position, and militarily they're far stronger than they have ever been. And their air defense system is robust, and their missiles are quite capable of penetrating and defeating Israeli air defense systems. So, like I said, Trump is stupidly pursuing a conflict that is quite avoidable.
And Trump knows that.
He should know that.
Here is what he said, by the way, Larry.
I asked one of the companies, I said, I want a lot of drones. And, you know, in the case of Iran, they make a good drone. And they make them for $35,000, $40,000. So I said to this company, I want to see it. They came in 2 weeks later with a drone that cost $41 million. I said, that's not what I'm talking about, $41 million. I'm talking about something for $35,000, $40,000 where you send thousands of them up. And that's a great way. And they're very good, too, and fast and deadly. Horrible, actually. When you look at what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, the drone is killing tremendous numbers of people. You hide behind a tree and the drone comes down and it circles.
Yeah, he knows. He knows what he's talking about. He has the information and how. And I was wondering if he would use this sort of information in the process of decisions that he's making right now.
Well, you'd hope he would, but I see no signs of it. You know, the fact that Witkoff out saying no enrichment whatsoever. Hey, you know, Iran's going to say that's unacceptable. So if that's your position, no deal.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Yeah. Glad I could start the week off with all this cheery news about how great things are. All right. We'll talk to you later this week, my friend.
Talk to you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.